From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a ghost in Brooke Williams' book. It's his great-great-great-grandfather, William Williams, who made his way to America in 1863 from England. He came west with the Mormon pioneers, but died along the way. Brooke Williams says he believes in some way, some other dimension, the dead live, that they know more than we do, and that they want to help. He says his life exploring the land, advocating for wilderness, has been profoundly influenced by this ghost. And because he didn't have much history to work with, Brooke Williams imagined a life for his grandfather in his book, a life he created from the elements of his own unconscious. Today in the program, Williams is joining us to talk about how he weaves these two stories together and how the common thread is a deep connection to an ancestral home. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For decades now, Brooke Williams has been an activist for environmental causes, particularly wilderness, identifying it, protecting it. And for years, he says he spent most of his time coming up with methods and strategies for this wilderness. But lately, he says something has changed. His point of view has shifted. Instead of saving wilderness, he says he thinks about wilderness as saving us. And it's an important distinction for him. He says this insight came to him basically when he met a ghost. There's a ghost in Brooke Williams' book. It's his great-great-great-grandfather, William Williams. And in the book, Brooke Williams takes the fragments of what he knows of William's real history, not much it turns out, and he combines them with the stories he imagines about his life. And then he combines William's story with his own as a way of expressing how we all experience the wild. The book is called Open Midnight. Brooke Williams is joining us today to talk about it. Williams has worked for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. He's the author of a number of books. He's written for Outside, Huffington Post, Orion, among others. He joined us from community radio station KZMU in Moab, and we began with William Williams. I asked him when he first heard of the man.
It was quite a while ago. I had this brilliant idea that I wanted to write a book comparing where I lived in Southern Utah, a place I'd grown to love and fallen in love with and had no genetic connection to, and compare that to where I came from, where my family roots were. So my father, who was very excited to acknowledge and support my view of Mormon history, sent me all my genealogy, and I realized I came from a lot of different places. The pedigree chart I had with me on the left side and all my great-great-great-grandparents on the right side, and then many, many people in between. It was a little bit overwhelming, so I created a criteria to narrow it down. And I wanted to pick one person and go follow them back to the homeland. So I picked a person who would have my last name, Williams, mm-hmm. who would have made the choice to leave Europe and come to America, and a person who I'd never heard of before. Huh. Because growing up in Utah, we all have our ancestors who have those faith-promoting stories that we've heard about over and over again. And I realized on that pedigree chart were dozens of people who I'd never heard of and who had just passed without leaving their story behind. William Williams' name was in the upper right-hand corner, and it kind of took on a neon quality, and I couldn't ignore it. He met those three criteria, so I started doing a little research, and that was the beginning.
You say that when you looked at that box on the chart of William Williams' name, you saw where he was born, you saw where he had died, a couple of details, but something about seeing that box, you say unlocked a door. Whatever door separated William and me, the dead from the living. What do you mean? What was unlocked there?
You know, it was one of those moments. Have you ever had a moment where you knew you had a phone number in your head that you had to call, yeah. but you couldn't quite remember it? Yeah. And then suddenly the four last digits just lined up perfectly and you knew it was right without even trying it. That idea of, you know, register, I love that term. I think it comes from the printing industry, but where a thought or something you see just seems to register and rise above all the confusion around it. That seemed to be what happened when I first saw that box on that pedigree chart.
I want to come back to this, the way you think about your relationship with William Williams. But I want to ask you first about this inner world that you write about, which you describe as this vast, dark, old, mysterious place. It was a place that you've kind of discovered that you thought you could only really access through your dreams. But through William Williams, in some way, you've come to this sense of an inner world. Describe that for us, if you would.
Yeah, I think a lot of this book is me exploring that question and to find out what these connections all mean and to, you know, research the literature for similar situations. And I was able to find a lot of information. I think that what you're describing now, what you're asking now, is this inner world as Carl Jung would have described the collective unconscious. And once I started looking into that and reading more about that in the best way I could, a lot of it was very technical and academic, but it seemed to me that what I was searching for was this place that is deep inside of all of us, that our evolutionary material is kept there. And I feel like there's many ways to access that. For me, being outdoors in the wilderness is one.
Right.
But I also feel like the dead help provide access to that also.
Yeah. So in that sense, and I know you refer to him sort of tongue-in-cheek at the beginning of the book as a ghost, but in some ways, you actually believe that there was, however you explain it, William Williams has had this influence, has had this, I'm not sure if he talks to you or somehow communicates with you, but it seems like he's this kind of gatekeeper in some ways to the inner world. Is that a right way to describe
it? Yeah, that's really astute. Yeah, it's not like I hear voices.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of just coincidences. There's a lot of events that happen to me that I can't quite explain any other way. And I've found that I'm not alone. The quantum physicists believe that we live in many different worlds and that the physical world is only one of them, and that when we die, our body may die and decay, but the rest of us goes on. And a book called The Dominion of the Dead was really helpful to me by a scholar at Stanford University, Robert Pogue Harrison. Mm-hmm. And when I found that book and read the first page, I thought, wow, this is so perfect. I can't believe I'm reading this. It's the what I really needed to have some confidence in what I'm writing about. And he believes, based on a lot of history and personal experience, that the dead are all around us. They have a very strong relationship with the unborn, so much so that their goal, their duty, is to work among the living to convince them to live in such a way that they keep the story going.
Mm.
I love that term. I've been working on issues of sustainability for a long time, and no one really has a definition for sustainability that everybody accepts. For me now, that's my definition of sustainable, of a sustainable world, is one in which we keep the story going.
Mm. I wonder, Brooke, you're no longer conventionally Mormon in any real way, but you're connected, obviously, to your family is quite Mormon. And I wonder about your perception of this magic, as you describe it, the sense of William Williams. How much of that is a remnant, do you think, of your life as a Mormon, your upbringing as a Mormon?
No, I haven't really thought about it, but that's really interesting, because I'm sure that it's played a role, my upbringing in the Mormon Church, that, you know, these things that happened with Joseph Smith and this idea of a Holy Ghost and so on has at least opened me up to the potential that there's something else going on out there. The question about what it is different and, for me, very personal and individual. But It's also something that, you know, we always learned you have to see something to believe it. I think it's the reverse. I think you have to believe that this is possible in order for it to happen, in order for you to see it.
So how do you describe it, what this book is? What's the literary conceit that you're working under? Is it fantasy? Is it literary license? You know, taking the barest fragments of an ancestor. You know, you see literary fiction all the time, but it doesn't seem like it's really that. It seems like there's something else going. I mean, how do you describe it?
You know, it's really amazing when I got together with Barbara Rass at Trinity University Press. And one of my big problems has been I wanted to write a book of nonfiction, but I didn't know that this was a book of nonfiction. There was, because of the fantasy, because of what the stories that I had to make up to fill in the gaps. And she looked at me and she said, you know, Brooke, just because you imagined it doesn't make it fiction. And that sort of opened a huge door for me. And then later on, I realized that, back to Carl Jung, that he believed that anything that occurs in our imaginations has its roots in our unconscious. So that makes it real, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And who's to say? I mean, when I read this now, after, you know, years spent writing it and then a year spent editing it and waiting, I read it now and I say, you know, maybe this character, this ancestor of mine is really an unconscious part of me that I'm slowly uncovering and bringing out into the surface.
It seems like that throughout the book to me, I have to say. It seems like, not to put down whatever kind of a reality you may think is there with William Williams, but I also get a sense that he's just the symbol for your conscience, saying the things to you that you don't always want to hear. I mean, there are a couple of moments like that where he's like, who the hell do you think you are? You know, what are you really doing?
Yeah, I know. That's definitely possible. But what's really amazing about the whole thing is that you and I right now, we're trying to put it in some kind of tidy little box so that we can explain it to ourselves based on the rules and of physics, the rules of, you know, protocol, the rules of literature. And yet I believe that something is really going on that I might not have been able to really put my finger on. But this book is just my exploring that connection.
Yeah. You say the story really began with one question. And here's the question. How can we protect more wilderness? So that was the starting point. But then other questions came to you. Why do I care about wilderness? And other questions. Explain that, if you would. What's the connection here to these big questions you have about wilderness?
So for years, I did what I call compatible economic development. The big argument against protecting wilderness, especially in southern Utah, was it will cost us jobs. You know, we make our living in coal mines and on oil rigs and cutting down trees, and if too much land is protected, we will not have access to those non-renewable resources. So my job that I gave myself was to look seriously into a new economy where protected places, protected areas, are seen as an economic engine in and of themselves without cutting things, drilling things, digging up stuff.
Right.
So that led to this epiphanal moment where, we save the wilderness because it saves us. And that's just a next step for me, because I think one thing that's been missing from the wilderness movement is that those of us who care about it don't spend enough time publicly expressing those moments, those transcendental experiences that we've had that turned us completely on our head and made us move into a direction in terms of preservation that we can never turn back on. Mm-hmm. And we're really good at legislation. We're really good at statistics and strategies. But only when we're together amongst ourselves do we talk about those moments, those experiences that we've had where we have been turned upside down. And that led me to this thinking of one day, Scott Groney, the director of SUA, and I were out in Beaver County in the Wawa Mountains looking at boundaries and roads. And it was late in the day, And we had wandered up on the side of this peak, and we were looking west, and the sun was just going down. And as far as we could see, there was absolutely nothing. Yeah. It wasn't scenic in the way that posters are made of photographs taken of these places. It was just flat. But it went on forever, and it was dead silent. And both of us just stared out at that, and I think both of us kind of got a chill sent up and down our neck. And I don't remember which one of us said it, but we both agreed that at some point in the future, this is what we are going to need. This is where what we are going to need to come to places like this and see off into the distance and be in absolute stillness and hear that true self, which Jung felt was the collective unconscious with the modern consciousness. That's what we're going to need to find the answers to questions that we're just now starting to ask.
Brooke Williams. His book is called Open Midnight, Where Ancestors and Wilderness Meet. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the environmental advocate Brooke Williams, who's written a book about his connection to wild places and his connection to his great-great-great-grandfather, who died while making his way west with the Mormon pioneers. Brooke Williams has an extraordinary connection to this man, William Williams. In fact, he calls him a kind of ghost figure. With little to go on, Brooke Williams imagined a life for William, and then he weaves that story in with his own in the book called Open Midnight, Where Ancestors and Wilderness Meet. He's joining us today from community radio station KZMU in Moab. So you go to Shrewsbury, where William Williams is born, and you discover he was born and raised in the same place as Charles Darwin. And you're imagining, even though you don't know for sure, that they must have known each other. They were only 10 months apart. Talk a little bit about that. What did you think about that connection as someone who must have already felt a connection to Darwin, knowing that your great-great-great-grandfather may have actually known the man?
That little connection there sort of short-circuited my work for years because Darwin was a hero of mine growing up through high school and college. I studied biology just because I loved the idea of natural selection, and I loved the every opportunity I had to explore where it was happening under the tutelage of some great mentors. I went to the Galapagos as soon as I could afford it out of college. The book of Darwin's called The Voyage of the Beagle was probably the most amazing adventure story I ever read. So the fact that these two people were born in the same place about the same time just kind of blew the top of my head off. And I spent a year or two trying to figure out if they in fact ever did know each other. Mm-hmm. And I could never discover that. I think that if they had met, which they probably did, I discovered that this town, Shrewsbury, during those years when Darwin and William Williams would have lived there together, probably had 25,000 residents. So it's possible that they did had met, but maybe didn't know each other. There's also this amazingly complex class system in England.
Yeah.
Darwin's family would have been at the upper levels of it, and William Williams at the very lower levels of it. So they may have known each other based on some sort of labor relationship. I don't know. But that became a big part of my life. And in the end, or not even in the end, but midway through, I realized that this whole relationship is a metaphor for history, that William Williams represents my personal history. And Charles Darwin, because of what he learned about connections and relationships among species, he represents this universal history, so that the two of them are connected. I'll never forget arriving in Shrewsbury, thinking that this is where I came from.
Yeah.
And then having the thought, oh, what, we got dropped here by some giant bird? No, we came from Africa like everybody else did.
Yeah.
That was just a piece of it. So that turns out to be the metaphor about history.
I want to come back to that idea of what is native. What does it mean to have an ancestral home? But I want to mention, have you talk a little bit about something that is really fascinating. You write in the book, you say, I don't know that William Williams' father built a stone wall for Charles Darwin's father, Dr. Darwin. I don't know that William became interested in nature's intricacies, particularly birds, because of Charles. I don't know that Charles and William stayed close when Charles left Shrewsbury to study. But you imagine all of those things. And it's William's father building a stone wall. That's what he did for a living that I want to ask you about. Because you say that there is some, this is how you put it, some genetically induced propensity, something in your DNA that has an affection for rocks, for stacking rocks and building things with rocks. Would you say something about that?
There's a lot about rocks and stacking rocks in this book. And I imagine that his father was a stonemason. And I think it's because I care so much about putting stones on top of each other. I love that idea of John Berger's where the delineation between history and prehistory was the turning of a stone upright.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That to me just even gives me chills to think about that possibility. And then to think about where I may be apocryphal, but that our earliest property was clearing the stones off of a field so that we could plant it, having nowhere to put the stones. So we built walls out of them, which separated us from our neighbors. That whole idea to me is really amazing. And then you start to look at the way stones are used today up in the Arctic in terms of wayfinding. But the rest of them are just, it's sort of a useful situation. There's no real magic in it anymore. And that's one of the things that I explored in this book.
There's a moment you write about how turning up a stone in Solitude Wash. There's a section here I want to have you read from this because you write about, as we'll hear from you, how moving stones opens this passage between worlds. Would you read this section? I'm not sure. Do we need to set it up?
Let's just read it. Moving stones opens a passage between worlds. Old time mixes with new, balances the mystery. That is what I felt that day in Solitude Wash. Moving rocks is different. Moving rocks can be a necessary pain in the ass. We've separated ourselves from the reservoir of our own deepest past, isolating us from our complete history. I imagine before cement, before pavement, the past and present mixing freely, all of us living in the present, one point in the infinite flow of time. Trapped now, the past builds up beneath us, pressurized. Tilting up that stone in Solitude Wash, release that pressure. I felt it. Not wind, not light, neither unfamiliar nor familiar. Beyond familiar in substance and flow and force, magnetism or gravity, but not quite. I saw time not as a measurement or scale, but as a force. Time became movement. My oldest cells came alive. My mammalian reptilian cells, my bacterial cells, activated by that swampy, sweet smell riding on a breeze, having just passed over something that has been buried for a long, long time. I sensed that what came up from beneath that rock, that stone, was dangerous to everything we've bet on.
You say in the book, it was early on in your discovery of William Williams that you learned about his voyage that brought him from England to America. This was in 1863. And you imagined William wanting to explore and, I guess, in research the land a bit like his friend, or at least the friend you imagine him having in Charles Darwin. And you imagine him wondering if he would be able to buy a microscope, for example, in Utah when he arrived. Do you know, I guess, the connection that you're making between Darwin and William? And William and Darwin, it seems you have a sense that they probably, at least you like the idea, that they both influenced each other's sense of the land.
Yeah. Yeah, that connection, it started out very simply and innocently, where I only knew so much on the line that was William Williams' life. I knew the date he was born. I knew the date that he died. I knew the date that he got on that ship. I knew the date that he got off that ship. And I knew where he died and where he was born. That was it. But it was on a line.
Yeah.
And there were big gaps on that line between those points that I just mentioned. Darwin's life was also on a line. And yet there were many more points because he's a historic figure. So what I did was put those two lines next to each other and see points that they may have overlapped or interacted. And that was when I just would sit down and at my computer and start to type, and these stories would come up. And I, again, back to your earlier observation, they may have come straight out of my unconscious, but nevertheless, they are possible. The first time they met, from my perspective, was when they were children.
Yeah.
And the day they met was the actual birthday of one of William Williams' siblings. So that I felt like they could have been together as that child was being born with Charles Darwin's father, who was the doctor that liked to treat these people for free, may have been, you know, assisting in that birth. So that was a real date. So that's kind of how it all happened. And yet, filling it in, I think I wrote in there, I'm not sure that this is exactly what happened, but I'm not sure that it didn't happen this way.
Did William Williams end up joining the Mormon Church? It sounds like he didn't.
No, he never did. And that was fascinating to me because I tried to imagine what it would have been like. The missionaries coming to England or into their neighborhood anyway, I think it was in 1855, and baptized his oldest son, which was my great-great-grandfather, along with some of the other children, and baptized Mary, his wife, in 1855. And it wasn't until 1863 that they all left for Utah, William having never been baptized. So that was a big question in my mind, is why that would have happened, why he waited the way he did.
You imagine a kind of tension in William's relationship with his wife, Mary, a gash, you say, in that relationship, but you think that he wanted to heal it in some way, maybe.
It could have been. It could have been that he had finally given in. He maybe the situation, I think a lot of people in England at that time, they saw the Mormon Church as something to believe in, but also a way out of an economic status that there was no other way out of. And it could have been that things got to a point where there was just no future for them. And that's when he agreed, you know, to make this trip.
What do you think William thought of uprooting his family and heading west? I know there's no way to know, but what do you imagine as you conceive of, you know, William's influence on you? Because you say you wonder if he had formed a multicolored dream in his mind about this new place. Was he terrified about leaving? What did he feel about not feeling connected to a new place? I mean, what do you imagine?
You know, the only thing I can speak about is maybe I imagine it in the way that if I was forced to leave where I live and move to a place where I had hardly any knowledge of, and it was as far away as that, I would really seriously think about doing it. And it would take a lot of situations to allow me to make that kind of a decision. So based on the little I knew of him, I imagine that it was really hard for him too, because, you know, we were close, and yeah. I'm sure we share a lot of the same feelings.
I like how you imagine him taking to birds, having this affection for birds, building birdhouses in England, and probably when he comes to this country, looking up and seeing, in those days, you know, the amazing array of birds.
Yeah. I can only imagine what those towns were. Shrewsbury was, as I mentioned, a big city. And I didn't really know much about where he actually lived until I got to England, and I went into they had a genealogy library, and I found the original handwritten, I forget which chart it is, like the pedigree chart, and it said, not Shrewsbury, it said Frankwell. And I asked the person at the desk, I said, oh, I thought this man was born in Shrewsbury, but it says here Frankwell. And she said, oh, Frankwell is a neighborhood in Shrewsbury. So it turned out I had already walked through the Frankwell neighborhood the day before, and it was right down the road from the Mount, which is the big home that Charles Darwin's father built up the hill, a five-minute walk from Frankwell. And it wasn't until a few days later I was in, I think, a cafeteria somewhere, and I saw a little stand with home-published pamphlets about the history of Charles Darwin. And it was hand-typed and bound together, and I read it that night, and one section really helped me. It said that Dr. Darwin liked to treat the poor people in the Frankwell neighborhood for free. So that led me to believe that the Frankwell neighborhood was that part of town where a lot of poor people lived. And I was able to look back through the history of Victorian England and found some information on exactly what that lower class lived like. And it wasn't pretty, in these one or two room houses where everything happened on the kitchen table, and they had very few possessions, and life was really, really difficult. And again, by asking a few questions and being open to it, my mind just flooded with images. And even at times, you know, the smell of the air, people cooking out on the street came to me, and I don't know where that came from. But yeah, so I had a sense that he lived in a, you know, in a quite a difficult situation, and that any opportunity that he got to get out, and a river, the Severn River, flows really between the Frankwell neighborhood and the rest of downtown Shrewsbury. So any river is going to have life and birds, and even in those Industrial Revolution days, pristine wildness. So I tried to imagine that too. I spent a lot of time wandering along that river.
It's interesting how you say, or imagine anyway, until the Mormons came knocking, that any chance for change in William Williams' life lay dormant in the depth of his own heart. So whatever he thought about Mormonism, he didn't end up joining, may have later, who knows, obviously. But whatever he thought about Mormonism, it did give him this new opportunity to go to this new place, changed his life. I mean, it may have been something that he longed for. And so in that sense, Mormonism was a good thing for him, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, all I can do is look at my own life and the privilege that I've had growing up where I've been able to grow up, traveled where I've been able to travel, all had its beginnings with that oldest son of William Williams coming to America and starting a life.
Yeah.
And probably with not much more than William Williams had. And yet, you know, his son and his grandson and his great-grandson, my father, provided me with an opportunity to do what I think are amazing things and to have a really great life and to really have the option to even be asking these questions. So you're exactly right. Had he made it, who knows what that would have done and what kind of dimension that would have added to his life. I'm sure it was huge.
I'm not sure if you have had a chance to see the review of your book in the Deseret News. I thought it was kind of interesting. I was a little confused by it, too. They liked the book. Rachel Chipman is the name of the person who wrote this. Loved the writing, said it was lyrical and evocative. But she also said the book had an anti-Mormon flavor. That's how she put it. And that you had taken some, I'll quote it here, pot shots throughout the book at various aspects of Mormon culture. What do you make of that?
You know, that is so interesting because I was very worried when I heard the Deseret News was going to review this book. And not because I felt like I had purposely taken pot shots or that I had, what did she call it, a disdainful perspective.
Yeah.
But what I really admire about what Rachel did, and I've never met her, I would like to, because I'd like to tell her this in person. I wrote her a note. And I would hope that I would have the same ability to really look objectively at a book that was really not, or even the reverse of what I philosophically believed, and to still make, you know, what I felt like were great judgments. I mean, I agree with her that the writing is good, for instance. She had every opportunity to write such a review that no one would ever want to read it. But in that last paragraph, it says, there are Mormon people that might enjoy this book, but there are others that won't like his anti-Mormon stance. But she just left it wide open, and I really appreciate that. And I don't think we see that every day nowadays.
Brooke Williams, his latest book is called Open Midnight. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Brooke Williams. We're talking about his new book, Open Midnight, Where Ancestors and Wilderness Meet. Well, I wonder, I'm not sure how many people know that you are married to Terry Tempest Williams, and I'm wondering, does that make it easier or harder to have her as a wife as you're trying to write a book and craft your own sort of identity as a writer?
Good question. I feel like it's really been such a benefit. She's got a literary voice that I don't know where it came from. I think she was born with it. And mine is more sort of, you know, pedestrian. And I try to write in such a way that you don't get stuck on the words. You kind of read right over them. Where with her writing, you really want to read every phrase as if it was poetry. And the ideas are there too. So it's really helped me because she's given me so much help in terms of helping me edit my work and ask me the right questions. And she's been so great about being able to say, look, you haven't gone deep enough here, that this is personal, but it's not so personal that it has become universal. And that's her way of saying, you know, if you're writing personally, it's got to be reach that point where it's a universal story. And that's the only one that people will really benefit from reading. Mm. So it's really been helpful. We don't really compete. I've spent like last half of year helping her with the details and the transportation and the getting her from place to place on a book tour, which was really intense. We went to over 20 national parks, and she gave, you know, literally dozens and dozens of readings. And so my job was, you know, helping out with that. At the same time, I was able to say to a lot of people, look, my book's coming out too, and now I'm going to some of those same bookstores.
Yeah.
So
nice.
She's really led the way, broken trail for me in many ways. And it, you know, I couldn't have asked for a better spouse and mentor and coach even.
You write in the book about your decision you and Terry made several years ago now to go and live in Castle Valley, this is interesting. You say it was a pretty big decision, unheard of in your family, that no one in your family really until then had gone outside of this 50-mile radius from Salt Lake City. And then you write about the valley, your connection to Castle Valley and how the valley may have been a hunting ground and this sort of significance. And then it raises this question that I wanted to get back to. You ask in the book whether it's possible to become native to a place. If it's not your ancestral home, can you become native to that place? Would you talk about that, your thinking about that?
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot, and I think one of the reasons that it came into my mind is that most of us who are, you know, white Euro-Americans have come, you know, our ancestors came from someplace else. We've arrived here, and especially in southern Utah, and right now we're dealing with this whole idea of this Bears Ears National Monument.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, this whole idea was largely driven by Native people who want to protect not only places where they can hunt and gather firewood and medicinal herbs, but places that have been sacred to them since the beginning of their time. And so when I went to England, I was suddenly confronted with the idea that I have Native ancestors too. The big difference is that our ancestors made a choice, either were forced into it economically or just saw the opportunities of coming to America. And with that was this decision to cut ourselves off from our roots. And we lost that idea of being Native or even any sense of what it meant or even any sense of how it felt. But when I was back there, and I read a lot of books while I was there about my Celtic and Druid ancestors, and there were some details that I discovered that make my Native ancestors not that different from the Native American people here, Native Australians, who knows, Native Japanese even, that there is a sense of being Native. And I think one of the main things that being Native is not being the conqueror or, you know, the person that comes in to take advantage of the resources and is, as part of that, has suppressed the Native people. So all that said, being Native to a place, I think, has, you know, many different ideas. There's the literal becoming Native to a place, which is maybe impossible, but you know, metaphorically, maybe it's not so impossible. It's when we decide to not be that conqueror that we can get a sense of what these places really mean. And that's why I think this Bear's Ears idea is so important, because it's really forcing a lot of us of European descent to pay attention to that idea of sacred lands. What do they mean? And what does being Native have to do with sacred places?
I'm going to have you read another section of the book where you talk about this idea. Read this section for us, will you?
The word sacred has many different meanings, both personal and culturally. My family considers sacred some of the early Mormon historical sites, the sacred grove where Joseph Smith had his revolutionary vision that seeded the religion. Personally, I have places in mind, caves where I've camped, mountaintops, thin canyons with light bouncing between walls, where a mysterious combination of events penetrated deeply inside me, so much so that I think of those places as sacred. But the idea of sacredness is not something we moderns spend much time contemplating. If it's possible to become Native, how long does it take? Feeling a hint of what it means to be Native was exhilarating at first, but then frustrating. Regardless of how much time I've spent in this landscape, as a white Euro-American, I'll always be a visitor. If a place like Castle Valley throws out signals to me based on the briefest possible whiff of personal history, imagine the signals it would be sending out to Native people whose history on this same land goes back 100 generations. How much more information would I be getting from this landscape if I were Native?
You write in the book, of course, you weave these different stories together, one of William Williams, one of your own relationship with land and your experience being an advocate for wilderness. You write about the political forces that you say are cutting and gutting and chipping away at this vision of public land, for example. And you talk about this relationship with a person who's a member of the Public Lands Council, a guy that you name him Guy, in fact. And I wanted to ask you about this relationship and the different species, the sort of subspecies of human. I won't oversimplify it, but in some ways it's liberal or conservative. You write about it in more complicated ways, but would you talk a little bit about that, how you speak different languages? Because, and we'll come back to this, but William's influence in your mind on all of this is interesting too.
You're talking about this Public Lands Council in Emory County, and part of my work at SUA was to go to meetings where the Emory County Commission had decided that they would solve this wilderness issue once and for all, and it would take this long process, and they appointed a Public Lands Council, and we would meet twice a month. And I would drive over and sit in these meetings, and we would talk about, you know, different aspects of wilderness. Eventually, we got down to borders. And that was where I realized that whatever compromise might have at one point been possible was not really possible. And that is because compromise is sort of meeting in the middle between two opposing visions or voices or opinions. And they would seem so far apart that anywhere in the middle was going to be unacceptable to either side. And that really caused me to think about what I was doing in a lot more detail. But some of the face of that is this guy named Guy.
Yeah.
And he was the most vocal and didn't care as much about being polite as he did making sure his views were known and that he was representing properly his philosophy and his feelings about public lands. And he was a real advocate for ATV use, for motors on the river, for a lot of roads as opposed to trails, and had no vision of all for a wild place that was not really beautifully scenic and of a transformative nature. He loved being out. He loved wildness, but he had no sense of we can make wilderness out of places that may not be beautifully scenic. So he became sort of the face of that, and the fact that he always rubbed me the wrong way and that I always felt my blood pressure rising a little whenever he spoke really caused me to look at myself and say, what is it about Guy that you're refusing to look at in yourself?
Yeah.
So he served a real purpose for me.
Did William Williams, in your mind, nudge you a bit to open your mind a bit, open your perspective?
Yeah, I think there's a section in the book where I'm going out to do some of my field work, and I stopped to open a gate, I think it was, and I had just been to a meeting where Guy was there. And I really had this strong sense when I got out that this, you know, this is really important lesson for me to take a look at. And you mentioned the idea of subspeciation. I just played with that idea about the same time, and I had just read a report on a test that was given to children under the age of 5, I think it was. And they were all judged by the results of this test to be divergent thinkers, meaning that anything is possible, meaning that they can take a stick and turn it into a spear, that the imagination in children is so big and their thinking is divergent, where their parents are convergent. And that means that they have an idea or a goal or something they need that needs getting done, and everything focuses on that one goal. And I felt like we were subspeciating into Homo sapien divergensis and Homo sapien convergi. And that was a moment where I thought, wow, William Williams is having some influence on me, because I thought, you know, that we need more coming together. We don't need more separation. So I've caught myself there, and I felt like that was influence from William Williams.
Let me finally, Brooke, come back to something you were talking about earlier, this idea that stories live as long as they're told, you say, and they die only when they're forgotten. But this strong belief that stories can be resurrected, you think that William Williams' story came back to life when you started to uncover it. I guess in some ways you think of yourself as the host of this story, kind of as a messenger.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't looked at it like that, but I do feel that way. I feel like the parts of his life that I was able to find that were real and, you know, connecting where he was with certain dates. I mean, I'll never forget discovering that his boat, the ship that he was on, the Sinosier, that he and his wife and his son were on, that came from England to New York, arrived the day after the New York riots ended, which the New York riots, as you remember, were all about the Civil War and the draft. Yeah. So, I mean, that to me is an amazing story. The fact that on his ship there were, 700 and something other saints, and you were able to now, with the computer, find, you know, the ship they came on and any journals that were written about that voyage. And even though he wasn't part of any of those journal entries or didn't write any of them because he couldn't read or write, I still was able to discover what he might have experienced on that ship. And it wasn't in general. It wasn't general like this happened on any of these ships, but it was specific to that voyage. And I feel like, to me, that's really amazing to start to have some vision of what this man lived through.
Brooke Williams. His book is called Open Midnight. He joined us from community radio station KZMU in Moab. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.